want to start today by explaining a little bit about handouts, that I always put some of the handouts here and two piles in the back, so there won't be a big line for the handouts. I don't think there's any other administrative stuff, because what I'm going to be doing is very similar to what Dr. Chazen did, except that I'm going to use chalk instead of PowerPoint. But we agree almost completely in the basic outlook, and we'll be recording the lectures as before. Now, today, I want to talk about nucleic acids. And the question is, why nucleic acids at this point? So I think the best thing to do is to ask, where are we? And Dr. Chazen summarized it a little bit at the end of last time before the exam, but I'll do it again. That was a while ago. So, what is the story so far? The theme in this class is, how does one cell or one E. coli, how does one make two? So what we've explained so far is how you build up the materials, the small molecules like amino acids and sugars, in order to double the supply. We've discussed energy metabolism, how you break things down to get the energy, and then how you use that energy to push the synthesis of the things you want to make. And what we found out is, what determines what you can do, what you can pull off? Why are you able to carry out a particular reaction and not another one? What do you need for that reaction you can do inside a cell? What did you say?
For the delta G to be favorable?
The delta G has to be favorable. You have to worry about that, but there's something else. Even if the delta G is extremely favorable, if you don't have the other thing, it's curtains.
Enzymes.
The magic word is enzymes about half the time. So if you know what enzymes to make, if the cell has the information for that, then the cell can run metabolism. Now, to be more general, the cell has to have the information to make not just enzymes, but all kinds of proteins. So what this comes down to is, to do all the things we've talked about so far, the cell has to be able to make the right set of proteins. Now, when you consider a protein, what do you have to specify in order to get a working protein? Is it enough to just specify the order of hooking up the amino acids? That's the primary structure. Does that determine the 3D structure? Yes, it does. So, in fact, if cells have the information in how to line up the amino acids and connect them, then we're in gravy. Of course, we have to worry about how much to make of each one and when, but the basic idea is the information. Okay, so you need enzymes, no problem. You need an enzyme to hook together the first two amino acids, say, lysine arch. But the next one's going to be ARG, say, and LU, so you need a different enzyme for that. But we've already used two enzymes just to hook three amino acids. So who hooks them? We have an infinite regression problem. So this leads one to the conclusion, and biochemists came to this conclusion, that there must be something for lining up the amino acids. And that is traditionally called a template. The biochemists also came to the conclusion that the template was not made of protein. It was made of something else. Now, if you want to think of the biochemist's view of the world, what does this template have to do? We've just said one thing. This template has to line up amino acids. It has to direct protein synthesis. But is that enough? Consider the question of one E. coli making two. The original E. coli has the instructions for making all the right proteins. What about those two daughter cells? Each of them must get a set of the instructions. So the template has to have a second function or a second job. It has to direct the synthesis of a copy of itself. So when the cell goes to divide, there are two copies, one for each daughter cell. this template has to do two jobs: direct protein synthesis and direct synthesis of more of itself. Now, biochemists called this a template. Geneticists call this the genetic information. Biochemists do things by taking things apart. Geneticists do things by looking at the pattern of inheritance. And they had come to the conclusion that there must be something they called the genetic information, or the genetic material that carried the genetic information. And this genetic material must have the information to run a cell, and it must be passed on from generation to generation to account for inherited differences that are passed on. Now, that is very close to these two jobs. Now, how do you put the geneticist view of it and the biochemist view of it together? Let's see if the board's dried off enough. Well, a little bit. Okay. So the idea is that the genetic material, the template or whatever that is, tells you how to make proteins, which proteins to make. And we know that the proteins do all the work, so the proteins does a job. And then, depending on how well that job gets done, that determines the trait. Now, for example, this protein doesn't have to be, but it could be an enzyme. So if that protein is an enzyme, what is its job? Its job is to catalyze something, X to Y. So the trait is going to depend on whether X to Y gets done or not. It's going to depend on whether X can be broken down or Y can be made or something like that. For example, suppose this is fructose. You've heard a lot about sugars. And Y is glucose. If you have the enzyme to do this, what's the trait? Let's look at it the other way. If you don't have the enzyme, what's going to be the consequence? You're not going to be able to convert fructose to glucose. You're not going to be able to live on fructose as an energy source or a carbon source. You're going to be okay with glucose, but you won't be able to grow on fructose. So trait here would be ability to grow on or break down fructose, etc. If Y, for example, is colored, then the trait may be color or absence of color. Okay, so the geneticists and the biochemists both arrived at the idea that something like this is going on. So what's your question? The next obvious question is, what is this made out of? Now, it turns out that with genetics alone, you can't figure it out. You can do crosses till doomsday, and you won't get the answer. With biochemistry alone, you can't get the answer either. You can take cells apart and check the parts, and you'll never get anywhere. You have to put the two of them together in order to get anywhere. And when the two of them combine forces using both methods at once, that's called molecular biology. And we're going to explain in a minute how a standard molecular biology experiment was used to figure out the nature of the genetic material. Okay, but I'm going to ask you first. Is there any in the... Well, I'll ask it this way. What's the genetic material made out of? Nucleic acids. What kind? DNA. I imagine that everybody in this room knows this. I once took a model of DNA to a supermarket, and the supermarket cashier said, DNA. I think everybody knows this. Just in case, I was on my way somewhere. Just in case you want to be convinced that everybody knows what DNA is, and that DNA is the genetic material, you should look at your handout for today, the one labeled AB. Look at the A side. What I have collected here are a bunch of popular culture references to DNA. For example, from DNA says, Disney says, High School Musical embodies the basic DNA of who we are. Another article says, institution-wide fundraising is far into the Smithsonian's DNA. Now, this has become a common figure of speech to use in the DNA to mean in the basic fundamental level of whatever it is. I have a whole collection of these. These two just fit. This crossword, I couldn't find an unfilled-in copy of this. I tried, but I couldn't. But the circled clues have something to do with DNA, and you can look at it later and see if you can figure out what it is. Well, maybe the pièce de résistance is the dog. That picture in back of the dog is an electrophoresis gel of fragments of the dog's DNA. There is a company, as it says on the bottom, DNA 11 analyzes the sample that you send them, takes a photo, and blows it up to create a big piece of artwork. In the original picture, it's red. So you can get a picture of that looks like that, either of your DNA, your dog's DNA, your friend's DNA, whatever you want. It only costs $200 to $1,000. So even pop art uses DNA these days. So everybody knows that DNA is the genetic material. And what I want to come back to now is how did scientists figure that out? And the answer is they did it using a phenomenon which is called transformation, which is written up there. Now, what's the problem here? Biochemists can take a cell and break it open and separate the parts using all the kinds of methods you've been talking about. Gel electrophoresis, columns, centrifuges. You can separate, say, the protein, the DNA, the RNA, whatever. But then, how are you going to know which one is the genetic material? That's the catch. Biochemistry gives you the pieces, but you don't have an assay or a test for which piece is the genetic material. And the assay, which is transformation, was actually discovered by accident. And it involves using a certain kind of bacteria that cause pneumonia. And there are two variations on this bacterium, which we'll call type 1 and 2. If you have the notes, there is a little table. If you don't, you can check afterwards. Let me just say that in general, both an outline and the notes for the next day are printed, are posted the night before, sometimes earlier. So these two types of bacteria, which we could call just type 1 and type 2, are also called PS plus and PS minus. Now, PS stands for polysaccharide. We're not specifying the details. And what the plus means is able to make said polysaccharide, and the minus means not able to make it. So type 1s have the polysaccharide. It forms a capsule around the cells. And as a result, when you grow the cells and you make colonies on a petri dish, the colonies from a PS plus bacterium are smooth. But the PS minus bacteria doesn't make the capsule around the individual cells. As a result, the colonies are rough. Now, this means that you can tell PS plus from PS minus without looking directly at the polysaccharide, just by the appearance of the colonies. But what makes this a really useful assay is a biological property difference between these bacteria. And that's whether they're virulent. That means, do they cause disease? It turns out that the smooth are and the rough are not. Now, what's the rationale behind this? When you get infected with one of these bacteria, or in an experiment, it's a mouse, when an organism is infected with these bacteria, if the bacteria can multiply, they will multiply and they will kill the host. And that's what happens if they're PS plus and smooth. But if they're PS minus and rough, they cannot multiply. perhaps because of the immune system, who knows why. But they can't multiply. And since they can't multiply, they don't kill the host. They just die off, and that's the end of them, but the host is fine. So you can tell which kind you have by infecting a mouse. If the mouse lives, they were PS minus. If the mouse dies, there was some PS plus in there. And that's the big useful test or assay here. What was discovered entirely by accident is if you take dead PS plus and live PS minus and you inject them into a mouse, let me ask you, what do you think should happen? If you just do dead PS plus by themselves, what do you think happens? Nothing. If you use live PS minus by themselves, what happens? Nothing. Good for the mouse. But if you do the two together, the mouse dies. And you recover from the mouse live PS plus. Now you can confirm in other ways that the dead are not being revived. What has happened is that the live PS minus are being converted or transformed into PS plus. And that property is inherited. To see what's going on here, it's probably useful to relate all of this to what we know about enzymes and genetic material. So what's going on in a PS plus type 1 and a PS minus type 2? Well, clearly, this one's making polysaccharide, but why? So it has, if you consider the genetic material, it has a stretch of genetic material which is operating properly. And this stretch of genetic material that tells the cell how to do something is what we usually call a gene. So it's a piece of genetic information, and it's functional. It's working. It's okay. And as a result, you make active working enzyme. What does the enzyme do? It converts some precursor into polysaccharide. So the cell is PS plus. This is what's going on in what you might say is the normal state of affairs, or if you're being infected, this is the state you don't want. Now, what's with a PS minus? They must not have this enzyme, so they can't make polysaccharide. Well, if they don't have the enzyme, that's because something's wrong with their genetic material. So there's a change in their genetic material. It's not functional. Either you can't read it out, or when you read it out, you get an enzyme that's altered and doesn't work. So you get inactive enzyme or none. But it doesn't matter whether it's dead enzyme or none, same thing happens. Can you make precursor into polysaccharide? No, because you don't have the enzyme to do it. So this is going to be blocked. So you're going to get PS minus. No polysaccharide. Okay, so what was going on? When you mix dead PS plus with live PS minus, some of the genetic material from the PS plus must have leaked into the PS minus. The genetic material now functioned. You made good enzyme, and the recipient became PS plus. And the property was inherited. Since it was inherited, we know it was the instructions that were transferred and not just the enzyme. If we transferred the enzyme, would the cell become PS plus? For temporarily? Yeah, why not? But that property wouldn't be inherited because you would pass on some enzyme but not the instructions to make more. So when one E. coli made two, the enzyme would be diluted in half, and when two made four, it would be diluted into four, and so on. All right. The next discovery was you didn't have to use dead PS plus. Yes?
What you just said, if you transferred the dead PS plus, could that have an active live enzyme?
Okay, so her question is, if the cell is dead, how can the enzyme inside possibly work? Well, enzymes are not alive. Enzymes are chemicals. And you can isolate an enzyme, and if you isolate it in its native 3D state, it will work in a test tube. So just because the cells are dead doesn't mean their enzymes don't work. Now, this, in fact, is the next step. You can take dead PS plus now, and you break them open and shake them with water. So you open them, and you add water, and you make what is called an extract. It's just a solution of bacteria, and you actually centrifuge it, and you get a precipitate, which is the big stuff that didn't dissolve, and then you get the soluble extract. You get the solution, which contains all the molecules of the cell that were water-soluble. And it turns out that this extract, this soluble extract, will also work. If I add, I don't have to add whole dead bacteria. I can add a solution of the guts, so to speak, of water, the water-soluble solution of dissolved bacteria, and that also will transform. It will turn PS plus to PS minus. Now, that means somewhere in here is the genetic material. It's in this solution. Because when I add this stuff to PS plus, they turn into PS minus, they turn into PS plus. Now, you can then fractionate this using the methods we've discussed into proteins, DNA, RNA, polysaccharide, etc. And now you can say which of those is the active ingredient. Which of these is the active transforming principle? Now, the truth is, there were only two good candidates at the time. People knew that chromosomes contained the genetic material, and chromosomes contained protein and DNA. So one of these was inevitably going to be the genetic material. Where do you think the bets were? On protein, because in spite of our infinite regression argument, who does everything? Proteins. So people assumed somehow, in ways they didn't understand, the genetic material would have to be protein. The active transforming principle or ingredient would have to be protein. But it isn't. It's DNA. Now, what does this mean? If you take the protein and you add it to PS minus cells, what happens? Nothing. So protein plus PS minus cells injected into mouse, okay for mouse. Same for RNA and polysaccharide. But if you take the DNA from a PS plus and you mix it with live PS minus, then this combination, if you inject it into a mouse, the mouse dies. And you recover live PS plus. So it turns out that it is DNA, which is the transforming material, which is the active ingredient, and which must be the genetic material. Yeah?
And so then are you saying that the enzyme, although it didn't die in the dead PS plus, the enzyme is somehow rendered inactive, and thus when you transfer that, that also is not able to make.
Let me reframe your question. What is the active ingredient? When you transfer, if you transfer enzyme from here to there, even if the enzyme is active, the property of PS plusness will not be inherited. Only if you transfer DNA, the genetic material, will the property of PS plusness be inherited. Now, what we are saying here is that dead DNA, chemically purified DNA, will carry out its job and can be transferred from one cell to another. And the DNA from the dead cells can be used by the live cells. It can be read out and used. Its information is still good, even though you killed the cell it came from. Yes.
So when you're injecting the DNA of PS plus into the live PS minus, but there's still DNA of the PS minus. So is it through evolution that basically the PS minus DNA gets just pushed out because all the cells that have more PS plus survive than PS minus?
The answer to your question is yes. What his question is when you add DNA from PS plus to PS minus, all the old DNA is still there. But in a small percentage of the cells, the PS plus piece replaces the parallel PS minus. Transformation is very inefficient. Only a very small number of cells that get the PS plus DNA actually use it and add it to their DNA. So why can we detect this if it's very inefficient? He said it's evolution, it's selection. Because if we convert one or two PS minus cells to PS plus, that's probably all it takes. Maybe it takes 10, maybe it takes 100. But I only need a few PS plus cells because I'm using this assay of what happens to the mouse. So if I put lots of PS minus and a few PS plus into a mouse, what happens? The PS minus just die. The PS plus multiply and take over. So that's one of the reasons this works, because I've set up an assay in which I can detect a very small number of changes. Now, this was discovered by the ability of DNA to convert PS minus to PS plus. It actually can be done the other way, it's just harder to detect. And it turns out that you can change any property of bacteria in this way. You can change ability to grow on, not inability to grow on fructose into ability to grow on fructose, etc. Now, what is the significance of this experiment? First of all, this is the first molecular biology experiment, according to many sources. It's the first combination of genetics and biochemistry. Well, we see what the biochemistry part is. That's taking apart the cell into its parts and testing them separately. What's the genetics part? Genetics is all about obtaining variants, crossing variant and normal, and seeing the inheritance pattern. It's about getting variants. You couldn't do this unless you had this variant. The genetics was required to select the PS minus variant, because only if you have two kinds can you tell if you had any change. We will, throughout this semester, be talking a lot about molecular biology, its results, its experiments, and we will do formal genetics only at the end. Now, so one reason this is important, as I said, is it's a classic, typical molecular biology experiment. Another reason this is important is this is really the foundational experiment for all genetic engineering. Because in this experiment, you've taken DNA from one organism, added it to another, and changed the properties of the recipient. Now, only a few organisms will take up DNA if you just add it. This happens to be one of them. But we've now discovered laboratory conditions where we can take a DNA from any organism virtually and get it into any other organism. So that we can now move DNA or genetic information around as we wish to. And this was the experiment that indicated we could do that. We can take DNA not just from one bacterium to another, but from people and put it in bacteria, or plants and put it in animals, and vice versa. Does that strike you as odd? When you take DNA out of an animal, for example, they're trying to make plants, for example, that have certain... They would love to have people who have chlorophyll in here and, you know, do a little photosynthesis. You just stand out in the light, you know. Why does anybody think that if you put a plant gene in a person, it would work? The world happens to be like that. All living things work approximately the same. Didn't have to be that way. It could be, you know, like some people use Macs, some people use IBMs, different use PCs, different operating systems. But it's not like that in the living world. All living things use the same operating system. They basically use DNA as the genetic material. They read it out more or less the same way to make protein, and then the protein does the work. The fact that all living things are so similar is, in fact, the best argument we have for common descent. Under the hood, so to speak, all living things are the same. And that's why if we want to know about people, we can study E. coli, or flies, or worms, or mice, and then extrapolate. Now, clearly, you're not a worm. So there are some very significant differences. But many of the basics are the same. Now, the other side of today's handout, the AB handout, the B side, in fact, exploits what I've just said. Now, there are two, the other side was fun. Two of these are real science. One of them is not. It says, through DNA testing, two students learn what's in their neighborhood. What's being exploited there is the common descent of all organisms. And so if you can look at the equivalent part in all different species, and it will be similar, but not the same. It will be similar enough that it will be recognizable. Like you take all cars and you get, say, the main axle. The main axle looks similar in all of them, but it's slightly different from model to model, and from the details you know which kind of car it came from. So in the same way they do what they call barcoding, they get the DNA of the equivalent gene from different living things, and they compare it. And so from the it's similar, but it's different in different species. They all have a main axle, but it's slightly different in each one. So from looking at its properties, you know which make of car, so to speak, or which species it came from. Now, these experiments were actually done by high school students on the Upper West Side. And some of their results are described here, as well as the results that their previous set of students got the year before. And one of the most interesting ones is they went to a sushi joint, and they sampled the fish. And what was advertised as white tuna, for instance, turned out to be tilapia. Which do you think is cheaper? Now, the question, of course, is if the customers can't tell the difference, who's being fooled here? But the point of this is by comparing the equivalent gene in different organisms, you can, in fact, find the origin of the sample. Yes?
Despite the similarity between all the organisms, you mentioned that only certain organisms can take up another one's gene and dish, you know, in a plate. Why, like, what about the bacteria allows them to just do that?
His question is, there must be differences because some bacteria, for example, can take up DNA and others cannot. Well, plants can do photosynthesis and you can't. Although the basic sort of housekeeping functions are the same and the basic operating system is the same, the software is different. So that there are additional genes and proteins that a plant has that allows it to photosynthesize that you don't have. And there are things you can do, like make muscle, which plants cannot do. So on top of these basic everybody's the same functions, you have a set of genes and proteins that are different from organism to organism.
In terms of transformation in particular, what allows the bacteria to...
What allows bacteria to take up DNA is actually receptors on the proteins on the surface of the cell, which bind the DNA and take it up. And some cells have that and some don't. okay. Now, this isn't a case of exploiting variations in a similar protein from species to species. But you can also exploit variations between individuals, so this is between different species, between individuals of the same species. There are parts of the DNA, because of their essential function and because of common descent, are very, very similar in us and in broccoli. But there are other parts of the DNA that vary enormously from human to human. And those are the basis of all forensics. And the little article here where it says DNA evidence exonerates inmate is an example of this. That by looking at enough variable regions in the DNA, you can characterize and distinguish the DNA of any one person in the world, essentially, from everybody else except their identical twin. So if you're going to commit a crime, be sure you have an identical twin. Now, these DNA matches, then, are used both to exclude and to exonerate the guilty by a lack of match, and by the presence of a match to, in fact, indict and convict the guilty. And this is just one typical article. There are zillions of these. And this is so common that you have this clue from the crossword from AM, the local rag, not the Times, 38, fingerprints or DNA. And the word in the crossword was evidence. So everybody knows that DNA these days is evidence. It's gotten so bad that when you have a case and there's no DNA, the jurors say, oh, there's no DNA? What's the matter? What kind of case is this? Okay. So DNA can be used then by exploiting differences either between individuals or between species for identification purposes. And this is one of the major interesting uses of DNA. And exactly how you do it and how you get that picture for the dog is something we'll talk about later. Because I want to come back now to another question. This experiment, this transformation business, has another implication, which we've sort of been ignoring, which is the obvious one. DNA is the genetic material. Now, at this point, when this experiment was done, people didn't really know much about the structure of DNA. And they couldn't figure out how DNA could be the genetic material. But this experiment led people to take a much closer look at the structure of DNA, both at its primary structure and its 3D structure. Now, think about with proteins. Until you understand the structure of proteins, you can't understand how they do what they do. In the same way, until you understand the structure of DNA, you can't understand what it does. So the question is, if we look closely at the structure, how will that help us decide how DNA does jobs 1 and 2? So what we're going to do now is take a close look first at the primary structure and then at the 3D structure of DNA. And all the details you need are on your handout, the stapled handout for today. Now, we're going to start with nucleotides, which are the monomers of DNA. When we did proteins, how did we do proteins? We started with amino acids and then considered how do you link them together. So with DNA, the unit is a nucleotide, and we're going to consider what's a nucleotide and how do you link them together to make a macromolecule. Now, nucleotides are a little more complicated than amino acids in that nucleotides themselves have pieces. So every nucleotide contains three pieces, which are written on your handout. A sugar, a base, and a phosphate. Now, we are primarily interested here in DNA. But it turns out that RNA is extremely similar. And so while we're at it, we're going to talk a little bit about RNA and how it's similar and different as we go along. And then after we talk about the structure of DNA, we'll come back and look a little more at RNA. Now, each of them has a sugar, and the names indicate what it is. So RNA stands for ribonucleic acid, so the sugar is just ribose. And DNA stands for deoxyribose nucleic acid. So its sugar is deoxyribose. And we've written both of them here for you using this format. So this is ribose. This is ribose. Now, deoxyribose is missing one oxygen, and it's missing this one. You start here. This is the anomeric carbon. This is carbon 1 prime, 2 prime, 3 prime. It's what's on the 2 prime hydroxyl that makes the difference between ribose and deoxyribose. In ribose, this is an OH. In deoxyribose, this is an H. Now, what this means is if you're going to link this thing up and you're going to form bonds, if RNA and DNA are linked up the same way, you can't use a reaction that requires a hydroxyl here, because RNA could do it, but DNA couldn't. So in fact, we're going to use these pieces to link. We're not going to use this piece when it comes to linkages. Now, we understand the numbering. This is the atomeric carbon. This is the one that used to be a double bond O, a keto, when it was a straight chain. So we number from there. But you notice that all these things have primes. The reason for that is in a nucleotide, there are two structures with numbers. The sugars have numbers and the bases have numbers. To keep it straight, the sugar positions are called 1 prime, 2 prime, blah, blah. And the ones in the base are called 1, 2, 3, 4, without the prime. So that allows you to keep it straight without having to say the 3 in the sugar. 3 prime means it's in the sugar. Now, this is the atomeric carbon, and that means this hydroxyl could have been up or down. One is alpha and one is beta. This is actually the alpha. In nucleotides, the linkage to the next guy is beta. You can see that if you look on the bottom, where we've drawn a complete nucleotide consisting of a sugar, a base, and a phosphate over here. You can see that the base is always drawn on top in the beta position. So the linkage is actually from a beta, not from an alpha. Okay. All right. Now, how are we going to link things up? In nucleotides, the sugar is the middleman. The sugar is linked to a base on one side and to a phosphate on the other. The base is linked to the 1 prime, and the phosphate is linked to the 6 prime. And I think for now, that's all you have to know about the sugars, unless there are questions before I go on. Yeah? Are there only 5 carbons? You are quite right, so this should be a 5. That's right. Any other questions? Okay. So let's look at the bases. Now, why are they called bases? Because they're bases. They have basic properties. That is, they pick up protons or H pluses in solution. But it turns out that for our purposes, whether they have basic properties or not is not so important. What is really important is what groups are hanging off the ring and how big they are. Now, you notice right away, I think, that there are 2 classes of bases written here. There are the smaller ones. Here they're written sideways, but same idea. There are the smaller ones that have 1 ring, and the bigger ones that have 2 rings. The top row is the single ring. The bottom row is the double ring. Now, these are named differently. The ones with a single ring are called pyrimidines, and the ones with the double ring are called purines. I find it easier to remember that the shorter name goes with the bigger base type. Now, both of them, there are 2 purines and 3 pyrimidines, and all pyrimidines, for example, have the same basic ring structure. But they have different things sticking out. And that's what turns out to be really important. Like, if you look at the one labeled C, it has NH2 here, N here, double bond O there. If you look at the one labeled U, it has double bond here, NH here, and double bond O here. Now, the reason this matters is that in DNA, these bases form pairs and hydrogen bonds. And what's sticking out here and what's at this position determines what kind of hydrogen bond you're going to make. B because oxygen is electron rich. So it's going to connect to an H from somewhere else. However, this H is electron poor, and it's going to connect to an N or an O from somewhere else. So what's important is what's sticking out here and what's available to form hydrogen bonds. And we'll see examples of that in a bit. Now, you notice that there are the four RNA bases are all listed. These letters stand for the first letter of the name. The names are written down in the little box. C is for cytosine, uracil, adenine, and guanine. Now, the two purines, adenine and guanine, are the same in DNA and RNA. But in DNA, the C is the same. But in DNA, this is the only base that's different. So where you have U and RNA, in the DNA, you have what is called T, which has a methyl here. Now, if you look on the right, you can compare T and U, and you notice this is the only difference. Now, the reason that you should keep in mind is, where do the hydrogen bonds form? Where are the groups that can make hydrogen bonds? And notice they're all over here on the right. And this difference of hydrogen or methyl is on the back side. It does not affect the ability to pair up and to form hydrogen bonds. But it serves as a tag to distinguish DNA from RNA. Chains of DNA have T in them. Chains of RNA have uracil. And of course, the other big difference is deoxyribose versus ribose. Now, DNA and RNA have to be different. It turns out that they serve a similar function of carrying information. But DNA is the master copy, and RNA is the working disposable copy. So one of these has to be very carefully preserved and copied. And one of these you can use, degrade, recycle, throw away. It should be obvious which is which. You have to take very good care of the DNA. You want almost no mistakes or damage. Now, you want an occasional mistake in copying because you want a supply of variants for selection to act on so that evolution can occur. So you don't want copying to be absolutely perfect, but you want it to be very, very good. And you want to protect your DNA from damage. RNA is different. Now, obviously, there has to be a difference. Are these differences significant? In the sense that, could it be the other way? Now, one way of looking at it is, for all we know, in the ancient times, there were organisms that did it the other way, where RNA was the master and DNA was the working. And in fact, we don't have any descendants of those left. So we suspect that that doesn't work as well. And one of the reasons for that is that these differences don't seem to be arbitrary. This difference, it turns out, makes it easier to repair DNA when it gets messed up. So this affects repair, ease of repair. And this difference, ribose versus deoxyribose, affects the degree of damage. Because of this hydroxyl over here on the ribose, RNA is much more chemically reactive than DNA is, and it's much more easily altered and damaged. DNA is much less reactive, much more inert, because there's no hydroxyl here to chemically react. So it looks like these differences are not arbitrary, and that by having one set in DNA and one set in RNA, that combination is more functional. We'll talk perhaps more about the details of this one later, of why U versus T and the repair later. You can look it up in your book, but I don't want to go into it right now. All right, so you have the base and you have the sugar. How are they connected? Well, either this position, which is the 3, or this position, which is the 9. In your picture, the 5-membered ring is on the other side. This position is actually connected to the sugar. So there's a nitrogen here, in the ring somewhere, depending on which base it is, there's a nitrogen with a hydrogen. And in the sugar, there is an OH group. And the removal of water here leads to a linkage between this carbon, 1', and either the N3 or the N9 of the base. And that's how you get that picture shown on the very bottom, where the base is up here. There'd be a nitrogen, carbon. There's a bond here in the base. Now, what about the phosphate? The phosphate is on the 5' end of the sugar. Now, you've met phosphate before many times, but remember, it looks like this. And then this, originally again, this was an OH, so by removing water between this OH and this H, we make a phosphoester bond. So the phosphoester, the phosphate is usually symbolized just as a P with a circle. Now this is the unionized form of phosphoric acid. Once this bond is made here, one or both of these may be ionized. We'll come back to the significance of that. Now, at this point, we've got, even to draw a single nucleotide is such a pain that I didn't do it. I didn't draw properly how this sugar is connected to this base, is connected to this phosphate, with all the atoms and everything. I gave you a handout. Even on the handout, it isn't drawn out completely. This is a mess. If I had to draw a long chain, and DNA is very long, it would be hopeless. So you need some sort of shorthand. And that's what page 2 is. Page 2 is an explanation of some of the shorthand that people use so they can symbolize what's going on more easily. So the sugar, which is a 5-membered ring, is often symbolized as just a straight line. Because remember, sugars can be written in a straight line formula. And when they are, this would be the 1', or the carbonyl. And now, these are the only two groups that are hooked up to anything. The 3' and the 5'. So this represents the 3', this represents the 5'. Now, we've already indicated that for the bases, the standard shorthand is just to say A when you mean adenine, C when you mean cytosine. Use the first letter of the base. Now, when you put these together, where does the base go? The base goes on the 1' position. So this would be ribose linked to adenine. Now, actually, whether this is ribose or deoxyribose, you cannot tell from this picture. You would have to know or would have to be specified because the 2' is not shown. The basic setup is the same. Now, what would you call this? This is a sugar and a base, but we don't have a phosphate. If you have all three, it's a nucleotide. If you just have a sugar and a base, it's called a nucleoside, as it says on your handout. So this would be called adenosine in this particular case, which is written on your handout. Now, what about phosphates? Where am I going to put the phosphate? The phosphate goes on the 5' end usually. So I could just write it like this. P with a circle symbolizing the phosphate properly ionized at the pH we're talking about. Now, in these pictures, it turns out the P can be on either side. It doesn't matter. And it also doesn't matter whether you write the O in, like this. Actually, all three of these mean the same thing. Depending on what point you want to make, you might draw it any one of these ways. Now, this is a nucleotide, because it has a sugar, a base, and a phosphate. And what would you call this? The usual name for this is adenosine monophosphate, or AMP. Have you ever met anything like this before? Good old ATP and ADP? All they are is with more phosphates. So I've written them down on the bottom. ADP is just the same thing with two phosphates. And ATP has three. Now, you may wonder, why has the same old molecule come up again? ATP is used for something else. It's involved in energy metabolism. What does it have to do with DNA? It's not uncommon for the same molecule to be used for more than one purpose. The argument is that cells have a certain toolkit, and they tend to use those pieces over and over again in as many ways as possible. So it is not really so surprising that ATP turns up twice, except if we're making DNA, it would be deoxy-AMP or ADP or ATP. If we're making RNA, it would be ATP, AMP, etc. So far, all we've got is a nucleotide. And what we're really interested in is a chain. How do you put them together? So on your handout, we've written a dinucleotide and the appropriate shorthand. So we have two of these. So this happens to be with A as the base. So if there were two of them here, this would also be a phosphate. Now, the question is, how are we going to hook these up? We're going to have to hook the phosphate of one of them to a hydroxyl of another one. Now, let's assume, because this is the convention, that this phosphate is going to be linked up to one of the hydroxyls. Which one are we going to use? Does it matter if it's DNA or RNA? Well, this is what you'd have in RNA, right? If this were DNA, we'd have an H. So is this always available? No. So if we're going to do it the same way all the time, we have to link to this one. That's the only thing left. So this phosphate, by the removal of water, is going to be linked to this hydroxyl. And now the phosphate actually is linked to one sugar on one side and one sugar, really a nucleoside on the other. So the phosphate is the link between this sugar and that sugar, and then each sugar has on it a base. So one way of writing that, if we use our standard terminology, is the base is on the sugar, but we've linked the 5 of this one to the 3 of that one. So it would look like this. Did I do it the right way? No, I did it the wrong way. Because you have to link the 5 of this one to the 3 of them. Yeah? I linked everything up beta and I draw it originally alpha. It's completely arbitrary whether it's written alpha or beta as a loose molecule because remember it can isomerize in solution. It can open and close. But it's always linked beta. Okay, so this is the terminology, the symbolism for a dinucleotide. Well, so what if you get a long chain? What does it look like? So on the next page on the right, on the upper right, we have actually a chain, a tetranucleotide, upping the ante here. Let's consider what are the critical features here that we have to know about. Now, the thing is drawn properly as one nucleotide linked to another one, linked to another one, etc. But as I said before, this is a mess and too hard to draw. So the way we've been doing it, we have really one a base with a sugar with G, a sugar with T, a sugar with T, and a sugar with A. Because this is G, C, T, A. Now, by convention, you write it so that you start with the base that has a free 5 prime end. Now, what do I mean by that? It might be clearer if we go back to here. There's a phosphate on this side and a hydroxyl on that one. But what is critical is not the phosphate versus the hydroxyl, but who is hooked to a neighbor. This group is hooked to a neighbor. But this and these two are each hooked to their neighbor, the 3 prime and the 5 prime. But this one is not hooked to anybody. So whether there's a phosphate here or a hydroxyl, as long as there's not another sugar, another nucleotide, this is called the 5 prime end, and this the 3 prime end. Now, in this case, there's a phosphate on the 5 prime end and a hydroxyl on the 3 prime end. One always writes things so that the 5 prime end is on the left and the 3 prime end is on the right. So that means that the bonds all go this way. And there's an even shorter version of this, which is GCTA. Now, when I write GCTA, why didn't I write the rest of it? Notice this part is always the same. There's a certain similarity here to what goes on with proteins. That you have a macromolecule, and it has a backbone, which repeats, which is always the same, no matter what sticks out. So this part down here is the backbone. With proteins, what are the two ends of it? There's an amino end and a carboxyl end. Here there's a 5 prime end and a 3 prime end. Now the convention with peptides is that the amino end always goes on the left. The convention with nucleotides is the 5 prime end always goes on the left. So when I write GCTA, we know G is on the 5 prime end. Now, this makes a difference because if I'm going to read this, if it has information, I have to know, is this GCTA or ATCG? They are not the same. Now, the only other thing to notice about this is that these phosphates, it's a little clearer if you look at the big picture. You notice that the phosphate here, there's an oxygen to the next one, and there's a double bond O, but there's an O minus. That one of those O's over here, if I wrote out my phosphate properly, one of the O's would be ionized. Now that matters, because if I consider this chain, there's a negative here, a negative here, there are a lot of negatives, one associated with each phosphate. And that's going to become important when we consider how is this folded up into three dimensions. All right. So now we have the primary structure of DNA. If we symbolize, this is a single nucleotide. The white thing is the sugar. The orange is the base. And this tubing is the phosphate. And we link it to another one. Again, the phosphate of one links to the sugar of the next, has its base, etc. So we would get something that looks like this. This is the primary structure of DNA. You've got the backbone, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, blah, 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 blah. And then you've got the bases sticking out. Now I have four colors, two and different sizes, but same idea, there are four of them, and so on. If this is what DNA looks like, can you conceive of it doing either job? Could it carry the information to line up proteins, amino acids? Well, let's see. Maybe green is amino acid 1, yellow is amino acid 2, etc. One of these tells you which amino acid to line up. That won't work. because there are only four choices. Oh, okay, maybe it's two at a time. Maybe green-green means one amino acid, yellow-red means another one. Well, if I have four things two at a time, there are only 16 combinations. So if I read it two at a time, that won't work either. But if I read it three at a time, I will have more than enough combinations. Because if I read it three at a time, there will actually be 64 combinations, and there are only 20 amino acids. So I have more than enough. And that is basically how it works. We will come back to the details later. But basically, you read it three at a time. So this specifies the first amino acid, this is the next amino acid, this is the next amino acid, etc. And since these are very, very long, they can contain enough information to line up the amino acids. So I haven't told you how it works, but at least it's believable. How does this do job two? How do I take one of these and make another one? Well, the general opinion was, beats me. Watson and Crick came in at this point, and they said, how is this folded in three dimensions? If we figure that out, maybe we'll see how DNA does job number two. So let's look very briefly at what information they had and how they put it together. They knew about the primary structure, and they're trying to figure out higher orders. And what they knew that DNA was very long and thin, but they knew something else. It was rigid. Not only was it long and thin, but it was rigid. Now that molecule I showed you is not rigid. They knew that if you heated it up or did procedures that broke weak bonds, if you break weak bonds, it becomes floppy. And in fact, it looked like it was hydrogen bonds. Now, they also had data from X-ray crystallography, which I'm not going to explain how it works, which gives you some idea of the repeating distances in the molecule. And there is considerable room for interpretation, but from the distances and the density of the molecule, they knew there was more than one chain per molecule. What they weren't sure of was whether two chains were twisted up or three chains were twisted up. Supposedly, Crick said, all biological things come in pairs. Think of the ark. Think of Noah's ark. Now, the truth is, he was as a-religious as you can possibly get, and I doubt if that was in his mind. But he's right that most biological things come in pairs, although there are proteins that have three chains. So he guessed correctly that there were two chains per molecule. And the question is, how were they connected? Now, Chargaff, inspired by the transformation experiment, had done a whole bunch of very tedious chemical experiments to take apart DNA and measure the proportions of the four bases. And that's on the last page of your handout on the bottom. Chargaff was at Columbia at the medical school at the time. Now, up until then, people had only looked at the DNA of bacteria. And if you look at the DNA of E. coli, what are the proportions of A, T, G, and C? E. coli. Remember, this is real experimental data, so it's all plus or minus a few percent. Notice they all look about the same. So people had the idea that DNA was 25% each, A, T, G, and C. But Chargaff very carefully took DNA from a whole bunch of sources and took it apart and measured the proportions of A, T, G, and C and noticed that it was not always that way. But there is a regularity in it. What is the regularity in it? Are any two columns usually the same? He found that the A equals T, approximately. The G pairs up with C. And remember, A and G are the two big ones. The number of purines, or big ones, equals the numbers of pyrimidines, equals 50%. So DNA is half big ones and half small ones. Now we know what the reason is. The reason is, I have to do this right, so I have to break it in the right place. We know that the two halves of the DNA are actually complementary. That you put A opposite T and G opposite C, and you get a nice even ladder because it's always one big purine and one little pyrimidine. And therefore, you form this regular structure, which, as we all know, is twisted into the famous double helix. Now, why didn't Watson and Crick see this immediately? They figured out it had to be a purine and a pyrimidine. That made sense. But they couldn't make it fit. And the reason they couldn't make it fit is because they didn't know about the structure of the bases. Now, before I tell you what they did, I should point out that Pauling, who was their competitor, published a model that looked like this. Watson and Crick were very worried about Pauling scooping them and beating them to it. When they read the publication of this, they laughed heartily, went to the pub and got drunk and said, "We have nothing to worry about." What is wrong with this model? Remember all those negatives? All the negatives, all the hydrophilic is in here away from the water, negative to negative. Now why, and these rings have a partially hydrophobic character. Why on earth would anybody come up with this? Notice this is the business end, right? This tells you what to do. Makes sense for it to be here for you to read. But in fact, Watson and Crick realized it was this one. And when they got this one, in fact, they went to the pub again and got drunk and declared to everybody that they had discovered the secret of life. And they asked Crick's wife, "What did you think of it?" And she said, "Nothing." He said that all the time. But they were right. Now, the reason they had trouble is if you look at the last page of your handout, you have here two forms of T. There's more on the handout. But this, in the time that they did their work, people were not absolutely sure what T looked like in solution. Whether it was this form, which is called keto, with two double bond O or keto groups, or whether it looked like this, which is called an enol. Now, the only difference is whether you put the hydrogen here on the O or whether you leave it on the N. If you move the hydrogen, then you have an OH, an N, and a double bond O. Now, Watson and Crick didn't know any chemistry, really, so they just looked it up in books. And when they looked it up in books, this is the T that they found, the enol. So Watson tried to make these groups hydrogen bond to A. He tried to make this H hydrogen bond to that H. Forget it. He tried to make this N hydrogen bond to that N. Forget it. What happened is one of his colleagues, who was a chemist, walked into the room, looked at his models and said, quote unquote, "Everybody knows, ha, that the form of T is the keto." At which point Crick said, "Oh." And he had the shop make a new set of models. And as soon as he made his new set of models and he lined them up, this is A, he saw that there was perfect hydrogen bonding, that this O hydrogen bonds to this H, that this H hydrogen bonds to this N. Now there's an H here. Why doesn't it hydrogen bond to that O? Well, if there's a hydrogen attached to a C, it's not electron deficient. There's equal sharing of electrons, and even if the hydrogen was long enough, which it isn't, it can't hydrogen bond. Not all hydrogens can hydrogen bond. So there are two hydrogen bonds here and three between G and C, and later when you get home you can check that out because it's drawn on page 3. Now, and there's also a question in your notes about checking to be sure you've got it. So as soon as he realized that Crick realized it was the keto form, he immediately came up with this. And Watson and Crick published a paper. And I just want to read you one or two lines from there and wrap this up. And there's some business about parallel, anti-parallel here, which we'll get to next time. This is what Watson and Crick wrote. "This structure has novel features which are of considerable biological interest." They also said, "The genetic implications of this structure have not escaped our notice." Now, what they meant was, any fool who looks at this can see how you do job 2. How do you do job two? How does DNA make DNA? Well, these are just hydrogen bonds. So you take, well, that one wasn't. That was a covalent bond. But you take the hydrogen bonds apart. This model is getting a little old. You take the hydrogen bonds apart. And the good part now is that suppose I lost this one. Do I have the information here to make a new one? Sure. I need the raw materials, energy, etc., but I've got it. Well, if I lost this one, and I have the necessary raw materials, I can make the partner to this. So that was what had not escaped their notice, that this molecule has two self-complementary halves, and each half can serve as template for the missing half, and one DNA can make two, and each descendant can get a new double. So next time we'll discuss, is that how it works? Now we're going to give back the exams for anybody who wants to wait. Yeah, coming. For anybody who doesn't. For anybody who doesn't want to wait, you can either pick it up after class tonight, or they will be in the boxes outside my office starting tomorrow. Now I think I'm missing a green.